I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. The daily White House coronavirus briefings are supposed to give the public the most current and critical information about how the country is combating COVID-19 from leading scientists in the field, people like Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx. Instead, they have become an opportunity for President Trump to score points against the press and too often disseminate misinformation. Here's the president on Monday claiming he has total power under the pandemic to open up the states for business.
When somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. And that's the way it's got to be.
The authority is total.
It's total. It's total.
Most constitutional scholars said, no, it's the governors who have that authority. This is just one of a number of false and misleading statements made by the president at these live briefings, which poses a problem to TV networks about how and whether to carry them. Here to talk about all of this is Mark Lukasiewicz, and he's the dean of the Lawrence Herbert School of Communication at Hofstra University. He's a former senior executive at NBC and ABC News. And Mark, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us is Lori Robertson, and she's managing editor of factcheck.org. And Lori, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Mark, let me begin with you. Do these briefings serve the public interest in that we are in the midst of a public health and economic crisis?
I'd separate the question into two, really. Do the briefings offer an opportunity to get information? Sure they do. Reporters challenging politicians, challenging experts, asking questions, always a good thing. Does the live airing of them, hours on end, without correction, unintermediated, serve the public? Not at all. I think it's a huge disservice to the public to air those live.
I want to pick up on that, but Lori, let me give you a chance to weigh in on that same question about whether this serves the public in a time of serious crisis.
Well, I mean, it's a little outside my purview since we don't offer our opinions at Fact Check, but stick to fact checking the briefings. You know, I will say from our point of view, though, we've had a wealth of material to deal with from these daily briefings.
What does that tell you?
Well, that there are a lot of false and misleading claims that have been made in the briefings.
Well, let's start with this question about opening up the states. That's the clip that we just heard. Now, the president was a little fuzzier about that yesterday, but what do or what did the constitutional experts say?
Sure. Yeah, we spoke to several constitutional experts who disagreed, who said that Trump was wrong, that he, not the governors, had that power. They said that the states have the power to issue stay-at-home orders and the similar restrictions that we've, in fact, seen the governors do under what are called police powers, and that there is no federal law that has given the president that power. In fact, if you look at what the federal government has issued in terms of these guidelines, that's what they're called, they're guidelines. And we did pursue a possibility that Trump may be referring to some presidential emergency action documents. A couple of scholars with NYU's Brennan Center for Justice wrote about this in the New York Times. And these are draft documents that could be put forth quickly to establish this type of presidential power in a national emergency. But it's very questionable whether these would be constitutional, and we don't know if that's, in fact, what the president was referring to.
Well, I know your organization doesn't do Pinocchios, but we can come away with a largely consensus from constitutional scholars is that the president does not have that power.
Exactly.
Mark, let me go back to you, and you raised the question about carrying these live. And I have to say, some media organizations are kind of dipping in and dipping out. Why? I mean, this is the president of the United States. Don't we deserve to hear him live?
Not for 2 hours a day, and not when the information he's giving is patently false or made up. Or contradictory. You know, let's just look back at the past number of weeks of these briefings, which have probably been averaging something like 90 minutes a day. And let's look at some of the highlights. Yesterday, and Lori, you're in the business, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe yesterday Dr. Birx, who sat in the Rose Garden cooling her heels for an hour waiting for the event to start, never once took the lectern yesterday, never answered a single question. So one of the top officials in the country from a public health perspective spent 2 hours of her time sitting on a folding chair in the Rose Garden. I don't think that's an effective use of her time. I don't think it's a public service. The president, in one briefing 2 days ago, said he was going to defund WHO. 16 minutes later, he was asked the question as a follow-up by a reporter, and he denied saying it, having just said it 16 minutes before, denied saying it, and then yesterday turns around and says he'll do it again. There was another briefing last week that was the coronavirus briefing, and into the Brady press briefing room marched the leadership of the Pentagon, and we heard for half an hour about a drug interdiction effort in Asia, which then morphed into a discussion of the wall of the Mexican border, drug gangs, et cetera, et cetera. These are political rallies. These are not coronavirus briefings by public health officials and emergency management officials who are competent in the authorities in that field. And the problem for me as a journalist my whole life is the idea that you can in real time fact check these events is really not practical and a non-starter. Take the event I just described, where the admirals and the generals walked into the room and gave a briefing about an Asian drug interdiction effort, and the president made a wide variety of assertions on that subject. We're asking that the reporters in the room somehow from thin air summon knowledge of the drug problem in Asia, the history of American efforts, and in real time in some way correct the president's statements. It's very difficult to do. It's difficult enough for factcheck.org, of which I am a great fan, to do that after the fact. To do it in real time is all but an impossibility. And my argument would be, let's send reporters to the briefing, let's do the briefings, and then let's air on a 15-minute delay, a 30-minute delay, whatever it takes, the portions of the briefing that are factual, that are important to the public, and that make sense. After all, that's what journalists do. We are not, if all journalism was pointing a live camera at a lectern somewhere and letting it run, I wouldn't have gotten into the business.
Well, let me turn back to you, Laurie. And I mean, Fact Check and other fact check organizations do not do this live. So you have the time and opportunity to be able to dig deep and to figure out whether what the president said was correct or not, and then go from there. Again, you don't do Pinocchio. So and I've read your materials, and they're very nuanced and they're very deeply researched. Do you have a feeling about just the challenges of trying to fact check anybody, including the president, live?
Yeah, I would agree with Mark on that. We feel that it can be not only incredibly difficult to do live fact checking because it does take a lot of research on some of these statements. Sometimes more so than you think when you first start to get into it. And on top of that, politicians can change the way they made a claim. Sometimes a small tweak in language changes what the claim is. So even if it's something that you've written about before, you do need to pay attention to the way they phrased it that time before you can fact check it live.
Let me read a couple of the headlines from factcheck.org. Trump's snowballing China travel claim. Trump's faulty malaria coronavirus connection. Trump falsely claims he inherited empty stockpile. Then there's one, I think, from today or yesterday. Conspiracy theory misinterprets goals of Gates Foundation. You don't use the word lie. Why not, Laurie?
We don't. It's a longstanding policy here at factcheck.org. And the main reason is that a lie describes an intention to deceive. And we don't know what somebody's intention is. And we can't prove that. We can't get inside someone's head. We don't know if they think they were right or they're mistaken or confused about something as opposed to lying. So we really don't use that word.
Mark, how do you feel about the word lie?
Well, I understand where Lori's coming from, and I think as a fact-checking organization, that's a perfectly legitimate posture to take. I think journalists, and this was a struggle during the coverage of the Trump campaign, I think the broad view of mainstream journalists has evolved on this issue, and you will see that word used a lot more than it was used during the campaign, because journalists do some investigating. They get to know their sources, and it does become clear that various people, including, unfortunately, the President of the United States, do intentionally deceive. They do lie. Corey Lewandowski, who was the architect of large chunks of the president's campaign, even testified in Congress under oath when asked about his lying that he felt no obligation to tell the truth to the media. That only under oath would he feel any obligation to tell the truth. There is lying going on. And you know, the challenge of covering this president involves, unfortunately, now making those kinds of judgments. Let me also say, Marty, there's a whole other layer to this, which is the sustained effort of this president and this administration to sow mistrust in the media, in the news, the major news organizations of the country over the past 3 years. So even when reporters challenge the president or challenge one of the administration's officials or lay out facts that are at odds with what the administration is saying, for a large swath of the American public, there is a view that that is fake news, that that is politically motivated. And consequently, it's dismissed. And I don't know whether Lori feels that some of the fact-checking suffers under that same apprehension, but there is certainly a variety of research out there on whether fact-checking is fundamentally effective or not.
Lori, the ball's in your court. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of research on that, and there's certainly been, since the 2016 election, a lot of discussion and concern that we're living in a, you know, quote unquote, post-fact world. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say that the visits to our website have been going up quite substantially during the coronavirus pandemic, during the 2016 election, and they've stayed fairly high even after that election. And we tend to have spikes during presidential elections, and then it goes off a little bit. And I think that those that traffic to our site gives us some evidence that there's a lot of people out there who still care very much about the facts and finding out what the truth is behind some of these claims.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Lori Robertson. She's managing editor of FactCheck.org. Also with us, Mark Lukashevitz, and he's the dean of the Lawrence Herbert School of Communication at Hofstra University, former senior executive at NBC and ABC News. And we are talking about fact-checking the president. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Paige, I got a bunch of comments I'll read after the break. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A president is judged ultimately on how they steer a country through a crisis, whether it's a terror attack or a devastating hurricane or a pandemic. We are assessing President Trump's management of the COVID-19 crisis with Mark Lukashevitz and with Lori Robertson. Let me read a couple of comments. Dave says, are the fact checkers wasting their time debunking the president's falsehoods that they may not know are false? The fact checkers are insinuating that the president is lying when he may just not know what he is talking about. A Facebook comment from Fran, if there is an important information to be had, I rely on my local politicians to spread the word. A Facebook comment from Margie, I no longer watch the press briefings. They're demoralizing. I hope the networks and other news organizations will stop covering on principle. Mark, let me go back to you. And I was checking your Twitter feed, and there was a chyron from, I guess, Monday's briefing from CNN, which said, angry Trump turns briefing into propaganda session. So, which raises a whole host of questions. So there's CNN and other news organizations, and I do not envy them whatsoever, trying to figure out how to cover these briefings. Does having a chyron like that, in a sense, sort of send the right kind of message about what's actually going on, or does it just confuse everything?
No, I think it confuses anything, everything. Why not just put up the chyron, CNN agrees to air propaganda session live? I mean, it is not an effective use of the airwaves. It is certainly not journalism. You know, you asked Marty in the prior segment, doesn't the public deserve to hear the president?
Right.
When I was at NBC News, I was involved in those decisions when the president, whether it was President Bush or President Obama, during my time in that role, stepped in front of a microphone. Did the broadcast network interrupt its regular programming to put the president on the air? And that was always a serious and sober decision. It was not an automatic decision. Mm-hmm. Presidents do make political speeches. Presidents like to be able to commandeer the airwaves, but the airwaves don't belong to the government of the United States in that way. They're licensed to the broadcasters, and the broadcasters get to make those decisions. So did we ever turn down President Obama when he wanted to address the nation? Yes, we did. It happened. And in this environment, while it is absolutely a crisis, let's not forget that in contrast to presidents a generation ago, this president has his own ways to communicate with the public. He doesn't need news networks to reach tens of millions of people. He has his own video operation at the White House. He has a campaign operation. He has his Twitter feed. You know, when John F. Kennedy wanted to talk to the nation about the Cuba crisis, he had to use the broadcast airwaves. That was all he had. Mm-hmm. It is not the same today. And I think the journalistic organizations that run these large channels have a responsibility to their public. Our job is to deliver real information, to ferret out the truth, to hold, you know, to hold people's feet to the fire, to speak truth to power. If a live transmission for 2 hours from the Rose Garden isn't doing that, it shouldn't be on television.
Let me play two more clips that we have from previous conversations that the president was having with reporters. The first one is from March 17th, when he claimed that he always considered the coronavirus a pandemic. We'll listen to that. And then we've got one more, which I'll set up right after we listen to this.
I've always known this is a pandemic. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. All you had to do is look at other countries. I think now it's in almost 120 countries all over the world. No, I've always viewed it as very serious. There was no difference yesterday from days before.
And another from March 6th, when the president is talking about the availability of coronavirus testing.
Anybody right now and yesterday, anybody that needs a test gets a test. They're there. They have the tests. And the tests are beautiful. Anybody that needs a test gets a test.
Lori, can you fact check those for us?
Sure. Yeah, we wrote about both of those. So on the first one, he said, I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. We don't know what Trump felt, right? So we said that in the story, but then said he had minimized the threat of the coronavirus for weeks in a series of statements. And then we laid out a timeline of these statements from January 22nd to March 10th. And on the second one, anybody that wants a test can get a test. So he said that on March 6th. Mm-hmm. We wrote a story about what was going on with the testing shortly thereafter. And the Association of Public Health Laboratories told us 3 days later on March 9th that although things had improved from a week prior, that the testing demand was greater than the tests that were available. Also, the vice president's office told us that the tests were available through the state labs at that time, but that doctors needed to contact the state lab to get one. So even by that standard, you would need a physician to agree that you needed a test. It wasn't the case that anybody who wanted the test could get one.
Mark, it's always tricky when you play something that is incorrect, even if you correct it or even talk about it. you've put it out there and given it some kind of veracity. How do we deal with this?
Well, that's, you know, this is one of the things journalists have struggled with. Some have advocated, you've probably heard the term, the truth sandwich, right?
Yes.
If you're going to report a false claim, then you go to the false claim, then you repeat the truth. But again, there's only anecdotal evidence that any of that works. In the meantime, you are amplifying the false information. As part of my role at NBC for many years, I produced political debates. You know, and fact-checking political debates was something you tried to do in real time. As Lori pointed out, it's very hard because politicians are very smart about things. I felt it was a pandemic. Well, as Lori rightly points out, we can't get inside the president's head to know what he felt at the moment. We can only point out what he said. But, you know, to your caller's question, maybe he's not lying. Maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about. I would submit from a journalist's point of view, either of those things makes those comments not suitable for live television. It's transmitting bad information at a time when information is critical to people's health. If you think for a moment just about the constant drumbeat from the lectern of the White House by the President of the United States, admittedly not a doctor, advocating the use of a particular drug, and I'm not going to repeat the name, but advocating for a particular drug that he feels, he thinks, he's heard, might be effective. That drug, A, has significant side effects, and B, is actually a vital drug for people in treatment for various other ailments. They're now having difficulty getting that drug in some cases because of the run on the drug caused by the president's comments. It does not serve the public to serve those things up live. And I think journalists, particularly journalists involved in live broadcasting, need to assert some control again over their programming and have a fidelity to truth and facts. And not simply turning over the airwaves to a political rally every day from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Are you saying they should boycott these briefings?
No, not at all. I'm saying they should go, they should ask the questions, but they should not air it live. There's simply no justification that I can see from a journalistic point of view to simply turn off the reporter's microphone, turn off the anchor's microphone, and turn over your cable channel or your airwaves to the lectern at the White House for 60, 90, 120 minutes at a time.
You wrote an article, one of the reasons you're on the show, and you wrote this article for Columbia Journalism Review talking about the things that we have been talking about on the air. But you also say it's important for journalists to write about what this president, or I guess any president, does versus what they say. Can you expand on that?
Sure. The president, for example, has talked about setting up a Google, you know, that Google was going to set up a massive website where Americans could go and find out whether they need a test. Right. That's what the president said he was going to do. He actually caused Deborah Birx to be part of that announcement. So she put her credibility on the line to make that announcement. That was not done. It did not happen. It is not true. So we should report on what Google actually is doing or is not doing, not what the president says is going to happen. And we've seen this over and over and over again, going back to how many miles of the wall in Mexico has been built, or what was happening with family detentions on the border. What the president says is not necessarily the reality, and reporters should be reporting primarily the reality. Again, particularly in this situation, when the reality of what's going on in the country with this pandemic is so vital to people's lives and livelihoods.
Lori, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on something. Mark mentioned one of your listeners commenting that maybe sometimes the president doesn't know whether or not something is true when he's saying it. And there were actually two interesting examples of that this month, where he admitted he didn't know, but he floated the idea in these press conferences. And they both concern the drugs that he's been promoting. He said that there were studies that malaria countries have very little of this virus. He was saying people take this drug for malaria. These countries have very little virus. But then he added, quote, I don't know. You're going to check it out. We did check it out, and in fact, we found no evidence of that. We found no studies. We found experts who said the drug is actually not widely used for malaria in much of the world. And then he did the same thing before that on lupus, said that there was a study he thought on people with lupus not getting COVID-19, but added, maybe that's correct, maybe that's not, check it out. Checked that out too. And did not find a study, didn't find evidence to back that up. In fact, we found a rheumatology association had a registry that, in fact, found people with lupus had contracted COVID-19.
Oh, wow. Wow. I mean, that's one of the reasons you wanted to do this program is that when the president says something that is false or wrong or misleading or disinformation, whatever you call it, Laurie, people's lives are at stake. I mean, this is such a critical time when we need to hear what is true.
Yeah, I mean, this has been, just a really interesting story for us to cover. We've gotten, like I said, so much more traffic to our website during this period. I suspect a lot of that are new visitors to the material that we're providing. And a lot of it, I suspect, are people who, you know, want information about this virus, that they're concerned about the pandemic and the risks and their health. The second kind of part of our coverage that we do is a lot of social media claims, false claims that people see on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. And we have just seen so many claims floating around social media about the virus, about supposed cures, and we've done just a plethora of stories on that.
And I'm glad you are. That's Laurie Robertson, again, managing editor of factcheck.org. Mark Lukasiewicz is with us as well. He's the dean of the Lawrence Herbert School of Communication at Hofstra University. He's also a former senior executive at NBC and ABC News. We're talking about these briefings, these daily briefings about the virus and the messages and messaging and misinformation, frankly, that has come from the President of the United States. Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Carol. I do watch. I mute the president and listen to the experts. A Facebook comment from Mary Beth. I watch daily to get information on COVID-19, but once the president turned it into a political platform, I stopped watching. A Facebook comment from David. They're nothing more than the replacement for MAGA rallies right now. The last few days have proved that. A Facebook comment from Kathleen. I watch them for as long as I can stand them. I'm down to roughly 2 minutes before I start feeling queasy. Mark, let me go back to you. And this is sort of the, I guess, the conundrum for members of the press, especially the White House press, about being, you know, wanting to have the front page story, wanting to be the first one to get a story. How to sort of manage that with all this misinformation?
Well, I think we shouldn't be, too precious about this, in the sense that journalists have always confronted people trying to deceive us. It goes with the territory. There's nothing new about this, and so I don't have any issue with reporters talking to the president, talking to Kellyanne Conway, talking to the vice president, being at these briefings and asking the best questions they can ask. No issue at all. My issue is simply, why broadcast it live and unintermediated? Why not perform the function of journalism with that material? I cannot think of another human being that MSNBC and CNN would troop across town to and set up a live camera for and turn over their airwaves to if they had a similar record of veracity to the people who show up at the lectern in the White House from the political operation of the White House every day. We wouldn't do it. And I think it stems from a tradition of deference to the presidency, of deference to the president, of an understanding that what happens from the lectern on the podium in the Brady press briefing room is generally important. But times have changed, and how that venue is being used by this White House is, as it is in many respects with other things with this White House, completely out of the norm, has thrown out all the rules and rule books of the past. And I think the news media has to adjust to that.
Well, I certainly remember from the 2016 campaign when a camera would be on a podium while, frankly, cable news was waiting for then-candidate Donald Trump to show up. Is Donald Trump catnip for a lot of the press?
Unfortunately, I think the answer is yes. I think he is controversial. He enjoys the banter with the media. You know, when you go to the White House as White House correspondent, having time to actually engage with the president is hugely valuable. Happens much more frequently with this president than with any president in memory. So there is that. There's another aspect of this too, which is very unfortunate and deeply troubling. This White House has shown that they are willing to punish media for not engaging with these briefings. When CNN last week started pulling back on their coverage of the briefings, the vice president's office banned Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci from appearing on CNN for a number of days. They were punishing CNN for not airing the president's remarks live. That's very troubling, and that's something, unfortunately, the news organizations have to weigh.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Mark Lukasiewicz, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. It's an important conversation.
Absolutely. He's dean of the Lawrence Herbert School of Communication. And Laurie Robertson, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Managing editor at factcheck.org. And we've got Eric Lipton who's going to be joining us after this very short break. Investigative reporter at the New York Times will be talking about their Sunday story. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Joining us now is investigative reporter Eric Lipton, who is one of the authors of the Sunday New York Times front page story about how President Trump dismissed and ignored warnings from within the government and his own administration about the threat that coronavirus posed to the United States. The expose reveals long simmering disputes and ideological battles among his advisors over China and trade policy, Trump's longstanding suspicion of the so-called deep state, the hangover from impeachment, and why so little was done in February to get ahead of the pandemic. Eric Lipton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Excuse me. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions about the Sunday New York Times story? Eric, what was the first time that the Trump administration, or even the president himself, was alerted to the existence, the possible threat of coronavirus?
Immediately, I'm sure that at the end of December, when news was first emerging from China that there was a unusual illness, and certainly within the first days of January, there were discussions going on among top advisors in the White House at the National Security Council and among members of the intelligence community. They're collecting information about the threat that this potentially presented to the United States. And they were already in January, in the first weeks of January, thinking that this was, you know, likely to be an illness that could come to the United States and could soon, you know, turn into a pandemic, just based on some of the initial reports that they were getting from China. There's a member of the National Security Council staff, Pottinger, last name, who had been worked in China during a previous infectious disease outbreak and spoke with a a friend of his from Hong Kong who's a doctor. And Pottinger was very concerned about the threat that this represented for the United States. And so we know that this was circulating in the National Security Council staff, and that staff is in the White House and is there to advise the president. And we also know that the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Azar, spoke with the president in January and communicated to him his concern that this was going to become potentially a severe health threat to the United States. And the president was dismissive of that and told him to calm down, basically.
Well, even Peter Navarro, the top trade advisor, I think this was January 29th, I think twice he raised concerns about, he's a China hawk, but raised concerns about this virus in China and whether the U.S. would be prepared for this eventual pandemic.
Yes. So Peter Navarro, who was advising the president in discussions with China about, the tariffs and the trade war, wrote a memo that in retrospect is incredibly, perceptive in saying that this could become a catastrophic event for the United States. And Navarro was kind of looked at as unreliable, and they was pushed to the side, and they wouldn't let him on the president's task force, which was advising him. And people just kind of like, it's just Navarro. And it just shows you that this is a White House that is lacking in sort of a oversight and leadership. That you have traditionally, you have the chief of staff, who is the chief of staff's job is to collect all of the opinions from all these smart people that work in the White House and to make a decision about which message is urgent to bring to the president. But at the time, we had an acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, who had been there for over a year in an acting capacity and who'd been completely handicapped after his comments in October, suggesting that, in fact, the Ukraine thing was a quid pro quo. And Mulvaney had lost much of his stature in the White House. And so another guy who wasn't that well respected. So the president didn't really respect his chief of staff. He didn't respect his Secretary of Health and Human Services, Azar, and Navarro was sort of laughed off by other people in the White House. It's sort of a dysfunctional White House that contributed to its inability to see clear and present danger coming right at it.
I do want to talk about February, but I do want to also talk about, and this is something that was in the story, about how the negotiations and, I guess, arguments about negotiations with China and trade may complicated whatever messaging was coming out of the White House or even disagreements within the White House.
Yeah, I mean, there was rival groups in the White House that the president, it's January, impeachment in the Senate was really, getting into full steam. But although it was known that he was never actually going to be convicted by the Senate in terms of the requirement for 2/3 majority. So that the end of that was in sight, and it ends in the first week of February. Mm-hmm. But January then therefore represents the beginning, really, of Trump's full time, reelection efforts. For them, the economy it was always been known that was going to be at the center of Trump's reelection. The stock markets, low unemployment, economic growth continuing through his tenure. And getting a deal done with China was central to that. I mean, for the farmers and soybean sales. So by January 15th was when they had anticipated having the phase one deal with China signed. And so anything that was going to disrupt this deal with China was, for many members of the administration in the White House, was just, off the table. You couldn't think of so the president was very weary of saying anything that was going to upset China, not only until January 15th when they signed the phase one deal, but then even after that, because they had to actually implement it and therefore have see China to starting to buy, soybeans and other products from American farmers. So that was another issue where you had health advisors who were saying we're about to face potentially a historic health calamity here, and then his economic advisors were saying you've got the election coming up, don't do anything to disrupt what is the core of your reelection message, which is look at the economy and how great it is. And the economic folks were the ones that dominated, and so Trump was, this will go away, look at the economy, how great it is, look at all the jobs we've created.
Well, in the beginning, the president was praising Xi and then more recently talking about the Chinese virus. Does that reveal something about his thinking then?
Yeah, I mean, there was a certain point where the president sort of flipped on and had been incredibly, complimentary of what China had done. And then all of a sudden, it became the White House message that they would call it Wuhan virus and be more pointed in blaming China for it and suggesting that they had covered up information about it, which it does in fact appear as if China was not forthright about when the virus first appeared, how broadly it spread, how many people died, all information that would have been vital to know to help the United States and other nations of the world prepare for it. But the president, you know, didn't want to be too critical of China because for him, the reelection was the front and center. And anything that was going to undermine the central element of his reelection strategy was just sort of not even non-negotiable. And that's where we basically January, February until the middle of March, that was the dominant kind of operative, thing that really drove policy.
Now, the president did shut down some travel from China, although it wasn't a complete ban. It was really for Chinese nationals coming into the United States, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of two phases in trying to respond to a pandemic. One is containment, and the second is mitigation. And so in the first phase of containment, the president did announce at the end of January this, limit on Chinese nationals coming to the United States. But in the period before he announced that, and from the time in which the infection had started to spread, something like 400,000 people had already come to the United States and China. So, I mean, it was an important step that the president took, and he got some criticism for it at the time. But even after that step was imposed, there were still something like 45,000 people that came from China, even after the, quote, ban. He's called it a ban. It wasn't a ban on flights in China. So, and the problem was the United States did not do proper quarantines of the people who did, in fact, come from China. And it was not a mandatory and supervised quarantine. And so the bottom line was that while he did take a pretty important step at the end of January, the containment effort quickly failed. But then they insisted, because Trump has always been obsessed with borders and the power, these enormous powers he thinks he has with border control. They were obsessed with the notion that they could contain this virus. They thought that, like we have these magical powers. It's this incredibly contagious thing. They thought somehow they could contain it. And for weeks and weeks it passed. And they were fixated on containment. I've talked to someone on the White House staff that was on the task force who told me himself, acknowledged in retrospect, that they were too fixated on containment, and so they waited too long to shift to mitigation. And there are many people who have died as a result.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Eric Lipton. He's investigative reporter for The New York Times, one of the authors of the Sunday story headlined, "He Could Have Seen What Was Coming Behind Trump's Failure on the Virus." Let's talk about this critical month of February. And you and your fellow writers at the Times really march us through various meetings and things that happened in March. So you've got the head of HHS, Azar, you've got Fauci, you've got Redfield from the CDC and some others having this critical meeting. This is the White House task force, and they're wargaming this flu pandemic. And what they come up with is really pretty frightening. This was the crimson contagion. What did they find?
Well, there had been a what they call a tabletop exercise in 2019, in which the United States simulated what would happen if there was an infectious disease, a respiratory disease that started in China. It's pretty incredible that they did this. And it started in China with some U.S. tourists that were in China, then flew back. And then the disease actually starts in this scenario in Chicago and then spreads throughout the United States. Something like 600,000 people die in this tabletop exercise. Several million are infected. So that's literally in 2019. They did this thing called Crimson Contagion. My colleague David Sanger and I wrote a story about that a couple of weeks ago, and about how they basically ignored all the lessons they learned from that. So the same guy, Robert Kalik, who ran Crimson Contagion, is now running the COVID-19 response in the United States. And so he's at Health and Human Services. And by the end of February, based on some information he'd gotten from a group of doctors who were studying the pandemic and how it was unfolding in the United States, he concluded that we needed to move to mitigation, the window was closing for our ability to shut down schools and businesses to stop many, many people from dying. And so Health and Human Services concluded that it was now time to inform the president that he needed to make an announcement that the time has come for us to take this unfortunate step of hurting our own economy, but we will save lives as a result. And that comes at the end of February. But the president chose, and not until the until the middle of March, and there was essentially a 3-week delay to actually announce that policy. And those 3 weeks, you know, again, look at what's happening in New York City. Those 3 weeks have enormous consequences.
Well, indeed. And the president was coming back from his trip to India. They were waiting for him to return. But in the meantime, and I'll quote her, Dr. Nancy Mezenier, director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, says about this time in February, quote, "We expect we will see community spread in this country. It's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness." So she is certainly raising the alarm, but that derails, for whatever reason, which we need to understand, that derails then this meeting that they want to have with the president.
Right. It's a pretty incredible moment in the kind of the history of this whole thing. When we look back at it a decade from now, that moment is like a critical, like, you know, you slow down and study it, because Trump was literally getting on the plane in India, getting ready to fly back to the United States when Nancy Messonnier at the CDC does this briefing for reporters. She speaks out, makes those statements. The stock market tanks. Trump goes crazy. He's angry. I mean, the stock market is such a core element of his reelection and his whole psyche. The stock market tanks. He's boiling on this long flight home from India. He lands at Andrews Air Force Base. He calls Secretary Azar from the Health and Human Services, reams him out over the fact that Nancy Messonnier has made this. And that derails for 3 weeks the intention by the United States government to notify governors across the United States that it's time to begin mitigation and it's time to shut down businesses and schools and to save tens of thousands of lives. Because Trump was so angry that the stock market had fallen, they delayed the announcements for several weeks.
And in fact, I believe you're right that Azar, who was heading up the task force, is replaced by Pence. Is that Vice President Pence? Is that correct?
The same day that Trump got back, the president replaced Azar as the head of the task force with Pence. And the primary purpose of that shift was message control, and that they no longer wanted their professionals from Health and Human Services to be in charge of the message. They wanted Pence to be in charge of the message, and the president knew he could control exactly what Pence said.
What has the White House response been to your story?
I mean, the president was very upset with the story. He spent, quite a bit of a press conference, calling it fake and disputing
the
facts.
This was on Monday, right? On Monday.
Yes. And going after one of my colleagues, Maggie Haberman in particular. But the facts are the facts, and much of this is detailed in emails that we obtained copies of. So it's all in black and white. There's not a single fact that they've undermined, and that's what happened. He did not play the leadership role that governors wanted, and therefore governors really had to choose on their own what to do, because they didn't have a clear message from the president or from the federal government. And some governors, like in California and Washington State, chose, and in Maryland, they chose to act, sooner. Other governors in New York and mayors chose to act later. And you just have to look at the map. There are actually 7 states now that these physicians have identified for me where the consequences of having gone to mitigation, 1 or 2 weeks later than they had recommended is causing deaths. And it's almost like a scientific thing that you can plot the consequences of the lateness of that choice.
Well, I wish we had more time, and I do appreciate you joining us and the work that you and your colleagues have been doing at the New York Times. Eric Lipton, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, he is investigative reporter at the New York Times, one of the authors of the Sunday story, "He Could Have Seen What Was Coming Behind Trump's Failure on the Virus." And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen, Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.